Before I start this, I just want to thank everybody. Sometimes it goes unnoticed, but brethren, God notices everything. And every little thing, every big thing that you do in the church and being a part of this church, it's very much appreciated. And also the enthusiasm and the exuberance. And we are an excited people, brethren. We certainly are, because we do have access to some of the most wonderful truth that exists anywhere. It's just a wonderful thing to know about these days that we are keeping. And I want to, again, go into what traditionally is known in many circles as Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur. Now you say, well, what's that? That, again, brethren, is the term that is given to the Day of Atonement, which we understand is the day mentioned in the Bible. But the Jewish people and many people who are keeping this day refer to it as Yom Kippur. It was interesting, last evening before sunset, I was driving home, and I normally listen to a radio personality at a certain hour prior to sunset. And it was interesting because the person that was doing a stand-in for him, he said, so-and-so is not here today. And then he proceeded to explain why. He says, well, he's keeping Yom Kippur. And he is a Jewish man. And apparently the Jewish people, a lot of them, if they don't keep the Sabbath, they don't keep any of the other days, they'll keep Yom Kippur. I figure they've done their part. It's kind of like I remember my dad. Well, you know, if he didn't go to church on Sunday every day of the week, at least he made sure of Christmas and Easter. And he felt like he was doing his job. But he made me go, right? He made me go to as much as possible. But Yom Kippur, brethren, basically the word Yom, Y-O-M, in Hebrew means day. And the word Kippur, K-I-P-P-U-R, that in Hebrew means to atone. So it's a day to atone. Brethren, there's so many things that come together on Yom Kippur that it's just overwhelming in a sense. Because it is a day that not only marks one day that's just ahead of us, the entry into the day of the millennium and Christ's return. We kept the Feast of Trumpets, and the Feast of Trumpets marks the time when Jesus Christ comes back. But then a short time later, the Day of Atonement marks the time when Jesus Christ is going to use his angelic host to corral Satan and his demons and to cast them in a bottomless pit for 1,000 years. That is the initial observance of the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, that Satan is going to be bound for 1,000 years. But the story continues after that, of course, because it continues on out into the future, the time when we come to the new heavens and the new earth after all is said and done. And at that point in time, Satan will be banished forever from that new heavens and new earth, some kind of a black void. We don't understand fully what that might be, but I suppose we could speculate a little bit. But the thing about spirit beings, brethren, is they can't repent. And it's kind of a head scratcher in a way when you ponder that, because in our experience as human beings, we can repent. We can have that free moral agency, but it's not all said and done one way or the other at a certain point. Now, what happened with Satan, brethren? Well, actually, prior to that, he was called Lucifer. We know that he was the shining star of the dawn, the greatest pinnacle of creation that God had made up until that point in time, whenever that was. But he was the pinnacle of creation on the angelic level. Of course, he was not God. He was below God. He was a little lower than God. He was not on the same level as God. But he did have free moral agency, brethren. He could choose. And when you look at it from God's perspective, one of the greatest tragedies that may have ever taken place in all eternity had to have been when Satan or Lucifer chose wrong, when he went wrong. Look at it from God's perspective, brethren. When God created Lucifer, you know, in my mind, I cannot imagine that he felt, well, say he's going to go bad. He's going to go the wrong way. He's going to choose wrong. He's going to turn bad. From God's perspective, at least in my thinking, rationally speaking, you would have to assume that God thought it's pretty much a given that nobody's going to make that kind of a, you know, insane choice. But he did. He did. And we're living with that today. We're living with the consequences of that today, brethren. And this day marks a turnaround, a time when that horrible choice that Lucifer made way back when, the correction, the rectification, it's going to be rectified and things are going to be made right. They really are. This day marks a breath of fresh air for all of humankind when they can get back to their original, incredible human potential. Because that incredible human potential, brethren, absolutely is that God is going to reproduce himself. If there's one truth in the Bible that you could file away in your mind and hang on to it, no matter what else, it is that truth, brethren. It's the most incredible truth that you can ever imagine, because we human beings, we are inquisitive. From birth, we kind of wonder, well, what is it all about? Why am I here? What is it all about? What's the purpose of life? And very few people have ever stumbled over the truths in the Bible. It's kind of interesting because when you read the Bible, it's a coded book. It comes across that way. There are a lot of people that read the Bible, but they don't understand the Bible. So there's a certain element that has to kick in. And God Almighty, brethren, has to intervene in the lives of those people that he's working with to clarify so their minds can read the truth, read the Bible, and it makes sense. It starts to make sense. And one of the most profound truths, brethren, that you can possibly stumble over, of course, is that God is reproducing himself. When did he decide to do that? When did he decide to do that? I mean, you kind of speculate a little bit about that. You know, people have different ideas, possibly, and so on. I mean, if he had decided to do that aeons ago, then perhaps Lucifer would have known about it, and something happened in his mind. I don't know. He seemed to be, you know, developing the carnal nature and so on and so forth. He seemed to be going in the wrong direction, going against the kind of character that God wants in his creation, created beings. And so he went in a wrong direction. It was a travesty, brethren. It was a terrible, terrible thing. I want you to read, please, if you will turn there to John, the first chapter. Because we go at the beginning. This day points back to a beginning. Because you have to get your perspective, brethren. You have to, when, to really understand the Day of Atonement, you have to get the perspective. Because why is the world the way it is now, 6,000 plus years since the recreation? Why? Why is it the way it was, or it is? What happened? In John, the first chapter, which is the first earliest recording in the Bible, it predates Genesis 1. But this goes even before Genesis 1, where it talks about, you know, the earth. This is before the earth. It says in verse 1 of John, the first chapter, in the beginning, brethren, before the universe, before the earth, before matter, before any of that, before angels, before you and I, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word, brethren, here is talking about Jesus Christ. It is a characterization of what he does. He is the one who communicates on behalf of God, but he is a person. He is an absolute person. And he has form and shape, of course. And the Word was with God. It says here, the Word was with God. For how long, brethren? You ask the question. Well, try eternity. Try to wrap your mind around that concept. But that is the truth. God and the Word have lived forever. Forever and ever and ever. Now, Lucifer and his angelic, the angels that followed him, they have not lived forever. Neither has Michael nor Gabriel. They have not lived forever. They were created at a certain point in time. It says here, and the Word was God. The Word was God. Doesn't matter what any theologian says, brethren. Whatever they want to talk about, the fact is that Jesus Christ is God, but he's a person. He is a person, just like God the Father is a person. Verse 2, the same was in the beginning with God. Same was in the beginning with God. It says here also in verse 3, all things were made by him. All things, everything you see, all the physical creation was made by Jesus Christ. He was the one who communicated what God told him to communicate. He might have said, well, you know, Christ, you give the command and all this matter will come into existence from something that looks like nothing, but really it is something, because we know that there is a spirit realm, a spirit dimension that exists throughout eternity. So somehow all these things came into being or came into existence from God's realm, supposedly. So all things were made by him. Without him was not anything made that was made. And then it goes on, of course, talks about in him was life. Now, this whole creation, brethren, is here for a purpose. It's here for a reason. The original reason, God placed Lucifer in charge of it, sort of like as a king in a way, or a government leader to exercise the government of God, and to learn how to make right choices. That's why he was put over the earth. That's why. To learn to build character, the character of the same mind as God. And I'm sure, brethren, I don't know about you, but I think about this and I think it's almost like a no-brainer. He's going to do it. You know, Lucifer is going to do it, but he didn't. I would think the chances were slim that he wouldn't, but he didn't do it. He absolutely turned astray and brought havoc and destruction on the earth and perhaps the visible universe around us, because we see many of the planets in a decaying state. So for some reason, brethren, he turned astray. Was he jealous over the fact that God perhaps is going to create humanity to become God, even higher than him? You ask the question, you can speculate. Something triggered in his mind to start to think wrong, to do wrong, and to be wrong. Perhaps we don't know exactly what that was, but it certainly did happen. In Job, the 38th chapter, Job 38, this may well be the next oldest verse in the Bible. I'd say oldest, but maybe the in terms of antiquity, going back into as far back as you possibly can. But here, brethren, is a it's a sort of like an exposition about the discussion that has been going on between Job and God. I won't go deeply into it, but I just will say at this point, essentially Job thought God had missed something, that God somehow was unaware of something. He didn't know what he was doing. You know, he allowed Job to be covered with boils. And Job felt that he needed to talk to God and say, you need to look at it from my perspective. I'm in agony. I'm in horrible pain. You just need to listen to me for a little bit. Please listen. I'm in agony. You're missing something, God. That's probably something that Job was, you know, he needed to rise to a much higher level of spirituality. But God was bringing him to that level, because in these verses here, he really talks about how great God is. God doesn't miss anything. He really doesn't. We think maybe he does. Like, in our humanness, we think, well, you know, I wish God had just kind of pay attention to me a little bit more. He's not listening to me. Well, he does, brethren. He's totally, completely aware. He's 100 yards in front of us in thinking and so on. He's totally there, 100% there. And so there's nothing that we can tell him that he's not aware of. He's way ahead of us. So he doesn't need us to sort of fill him in, you know, to kind of say, well, you know, you really need to listen to me, God. I mean, I'm pretty smart. No, you're not pretty smart. You're just a human being. But that's essentially the discussion here. But it brings us to a point here. Let's read these verses very quickly. It says, then the Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind. That's apparently was Jesus Christ that was the one answering him in this particular instance. And said, verse 2, who is this that darkens counsel? You know what you're talking about, Job. By words without knowledge. Job, you're talking like an idiot. You know what you're saying. 3, gird up your loins, or get dressed. Stand up and stand like a man. And I'm going to demand of you, answer you me. This is God talking to Job and putting Job in his place and saying, you, Job, you really need to consider how the greatness of God and realize he really knows what he's doing. He really does. Verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare it if you have understanding. Where were you? Where were you, Job? Job says, well, you know, probably not even thought of. Verse 5, who has laid the measure thereof? If you know, or who has stretched the line upon it? Who, you know, sort of like, you know, it's speculated that Job may have had something to do with the pyramids, possibly, maybe not, but he may have been a builder of significance in ancient times. Job may well have been, because he was a man of wealth. And so he's talking about, well, you built this, you built that. I built the earth, Job. How does that make you feel? You start to think a little bit? Verse 6, where the foundations were fastened, and who laid the cornerstone of it? Who did all this? Do you know who you're talking to, Job? That was basically, this whole book of Job is based on the fact, brethren, that Job thought he really knew a lot, and God was missing something. It was really reversed. God knows everything, brethren. He's so far out in front of us. And we need to deeply and profoundly respect him and respect what he is doing with us as people in our lives, and to really trust him. But the verse I want to focus on mostly here in this group of verses, brethren, is verse 7. This verse is filled with a lot of truth. Verse 7, when the morning stars, which is code word for angels, the morning stars, that's one of the terms used in Bible to talk about angels. When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Brethren, Lucifer was among the sons of God at this particular point, whenever that was. all of the angels somehow step back and they watch the creation of the physical universe and the earth, the beauty of it, all of the creation. Brethren, they sang for joy. They sang for joy. Because there's another part to this story I won't go into. I'll just mention it quickly. One of the reasons they sang for joy is because they were going to be given rulership over that creation for a time. Now, one of the purposes, brethren, for that was to develop God's character and nature so you can play it out. You know, if you don't have a place to live, if you don't have a place to work, if you don't have a place to live your life, then you can't kind of test yourself to see, well, am I doing good or am I doing bad? You know, you take away everything. There's no way to test to see how I'm doing. And that's part of it, brethren. That's part of the reason for the creation, is so that we could build character. Now, the angels were given that opportunity to take care of God's animals, take care of the creation, to care for it. You know, it says in Genesis, the second chapter, verse 15, I believe it is. I won't go there, but it says, God put Adam and Eve in the garden to dress and to keep it. Now, why? Why did he do that? Just so, you know, God had somebody to take care of his creation? Or for even a greater purpose, where he could develop the character of God, to take care of God's things, but to look at it and to do it from God's perspective. You see, brethren, when you realize that, we realize what a travesty and a tragedy it was for Lucifer to fail, for Lucifer to come short. What an absolutely sad thing that is, brethren. And again, we're reaping the benefits of that to this very day, but not for long, because in a few years, however long it is, God is going to step in and he's going to take Satan and he's going to bind him. And that will be the first part of the fulfillment of the Day of Atonement. So I want to go to Mark, the second chapter, brethren, very quickly. You know, I don't normally drink water when I speak, but this is the first time I ever felt like drinking water. But anyway. Brethren, God made all things, including the Sabbath, including the Day of Atonement, to celebrate and so on. But he didn't make it so that, well, my Day of Atonement, my Sabbath, I just have to have a group of people that are going to keep it. No. He made the Day of Atonement and the Sabbath and gave the earth to us for our benefit. That's what he did. In other words, the creation is for our blessing, our benefit, as you see in verse 27 of Mark, the second chapter. I hope I'm making this clear enough, brother. But anyway, Mark 2, verse 27. Jesus said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. There's a little bit of depth there, brethren, because what he's talking about essentially is the creation was made for man, not man for the creation, not turned around. So it's here for a purpose, brethren. It's here to benefit us. It's here to help us in our calling and our mission, to be part of the great purpose that God is working out here below. And that is a phenomenal thing. Let's go to Hebrews, the first chapter. One of the purposes of the angels, why they were created, or, you know, their ultimate purpose after man was created, they were given a responsibility. They were given an assignment. I don't know, if Lucifer was viewing this, he may have thought, I don't want that assignment. I want to be the king of the mountain and so on and so forth. I want to be up here. I don't want man to be up here. I want to be up here. And that's possibly what he was thinking. Anyways, Hebrews 1 verse 7. Of the angels, he says, who makes his angels spirits and his ministers a flame of fire. And then verse 14, what the angels should have been quite happy and willing to do is, verse 14, are these not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? Brethren, isn't it interesting? Two-thirds of the angels remained loyal to God. Michael and Gabriel and all of that host of angels seem to be quite happy to be the ministering angels and spirits and agents to take care of, yes, you and I at this point in time, to try to help us to go, to make our way towards salvation. For some reason, brethren, that wasn't good enough for Lucifer. He did not want to be that kind of agent. He did not want to minister to the human beings that God would create. And so you can see that something happened in his mind, brethren. Something happened. Now, Hebrews 2, and I believe it's verse 8. I want to read that very quickly. Hebrews 2. Okay. Yeah, it says here, these in verse 7, you have made him, human beings, a little while lower than the angels. A little while lower. Brenda, you see the competition. In the world today, everybody strives for the chief seat. Everybody wants to be number one. It's human, it's carnal, it's vanity. Everybody wants to be the top dog for obvious reasons. Then you can say, well, you polish my shoes and kiss my feet. That's the way human nature works. And you can see that this bitter attitude that took hold of Lucifer and the angels that he was able to influence took hold. And it wasn't good enough, brethren, for him to be a ministering agent, a ministering spirit, for those who are heirs of salvation, us who are going to be born into the family of God. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't good enough. But again, it was seemed to be fine with Michael and Gabriel, the other two archangels, because there were three of them. Let's go to Ezekiel, the 38th chapter. Ezekiel 38 is a prehistoric account. No, sorry. This is not a prehistoric account. This is another verse. But anyway, this here is talking about the hordes of the kings of the east and the north at the end of the millennial reign of Christ. All of a sudden, some kind of spirit takes hold of them and they come up to Jerusalem to fight against it. And they're going to be suddenly under the influence of Satan, who will be let loose from his prison, or from his prison. And they will come up and fight at the end of the millennium. Where does this come from? That just doesn't make sense in a way, unless you throw into the mix, into the equation, Satan loosed for a short time. Now look at what he does to these people, brethren. Look at what he does to this massive people, this massive army that will converge up to Jerusalem in the very final days, the waning days of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, just for a very short time. It says here in Ezekiel, the 38th chapter, verse 10. Look at this. Thus says the Eternal God, It shall also come to pass that at that same time shall things come into your mind, and you will think an evil thought. Brethren, human beings are quite capable of doing that without Satan, but it becomes more probable with Satan. Because that's what he does. The foment, the building up in this world of all of the tension, the warfare, the destruction. Well, the source, it comes from Satan, of course. It comes from Satan and his demons. And they stir things up. And he's quite capable, brethren, of, you know, forcing something to come into their minds, the minds of this army, and they will think an evil thought all of a sudden after 950, 975, 990 years of beautiful peace and harmony of the Garden of Eden on earth, really, that's what it'll be. All of a sudden, a wrong thought masticizes and grabs a hold of these people, and destruction ensues. Brethren, that's what happened to Satan originally, or Lucifer. Somehow a thought lodged in his mind, and it made him go sour or bad. And so, brethren, because of that, we have continued right down to this very day with a spirit that is impacting the world scene, the stage, and creating havoc in this world. And this world, brethren, is on a crash course to destruction unless there's an intervention. But there will be, won't there? Let's go to Ephesians, the second chapter. Ephesians 2, and we can read here. Ephesians, the second chapter, and oh, I'm looking at verse chapter 1. Why didn't you tell me? Just amazing what you do when you don't have what are they, carbohydrates keep you thinking. Ephesians 2 and verse 2. Verse 1, actually. And you has he enlivened. He's talking to us, brethren, who were dead in trespasses or sin, who were going the way of the world. That's the way we were going. God grabbed a hold of us by the scruff of the neck, turned us around, set us on a new course. But look at what was going on in our lives, brethren, because we were subjected to this. Verse 2 of Ephesians 2. Wherein, in time past, you walked according to the course of this world. Brethren, that pressure is out there. Satan is the prince of the power of the air. He's very real. The Bible is true. It is the truth. And Satan, of course, is that prince of the power of the air. Somehow, he's able to work on the minds of human beings to put wrong thoughts in them. I mean, I've met a lot of very nice people, brethren, but they can't speak for half a minute without swearing. You know, they can't speak for half a minute without saying something negative, carnal, and all the rest of it. Well, I think God's people are a little bit different than that. We seem to have the strength and the power at our disposal. We can actually make good strides in keeping God's law. But that prince of the power of the air, brethren, is very active. Very, very active. And he's getting worse. As we speak, it's getting worse. Don't give him a pass, brethren. Don't do it. Don't think, oh, well, he's way over here somewhere, way over there somewhere. I'm okay. I don't have to worry about that. Brethren, every single day we ought to pray for his protection, God's protection. We really should, especially as the age draws to a close. because he's getting more and more panicked because he's going to lose control of the earth. That's what he's going to do. It's going to be taken from him. At this particular point in time, the only place apparently that is left to his control is the earth. You know, he probably doesn't have control anywhere else as far as that goes. He was banished to the earth anciently. And he's making the best of it in every way you can possibly imagine. You know, I read these statistics a week ago about military, the amount of money spent on military. Well, in a world like this, nations would be crazy not to spend money on military to try to protect themselves because the other one is belligerent and you know where that's going to end. And it's all because Satan has stirred up this attitude of hatred, of lack of being able to get along with your neighbor. But again, here it says, wherein in time past you walked according to the course of the world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. And sadly, brethren, that is the state of the world. It really is. It is a world of disobedience. It really is. But that, again, the best part of the story is that soon about to change. Now, Luke, the 10th chapter, brings here an account where somehow vaguely in Jesus Christ's mind as a human being, it's probable that he could not bring up fully to memory what he experienced as the divine member of the God family, as he was prior to becoming, you know, the human Jesus. But there was some kind of an inkling of a sense. He knew he had witnessed it. He knew that he had seen this happen. In John the 10th chapter, sorry, Luke the 10th chapter, I'm sorry, Luke the 10th chapter, we read here of something that Jesus sort of vaguely remembered in prehistory of what happened to a certain individual. He says, verse 17, the 70 returned again with joy, saying, Lord, even the devils are subject to us through your name. Brethren, that's one of the powers that God's church does have if it knows how to access it and knows how to utilize it, because Jesus Christ said he's given us that special blessing. But another thing here, in verse 18, Christ said to them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. That was an actual incident that happened, brethren. Because apparently Satan attacked the third heaven where God's throne is. He apparently did that. How insane is that? Fighting God and you think you're going to win? That is the ultimate of insanity. But in actual fact, that's what he did. So we see that Jesus Christ, who was there in this monumental battle in the third heaven, and Satan, of course, was pulling out all stops, and he says, I'm going to take over. I should be God. That's what he was thinking. I should be God. You see that in the world stage, brethren. People get so filled with vanity, they think they're smarter than God. You talk to some scientists, brethren, they think they actually know more. They think they know basically everything. But they're so deceived, brethren, and that's vanity. Well, that's what happened to Satan. I should be God. That's what he thought. And he decided to attack. But it says he lost that thing miserably. And Christ said, I saw Satan fall as lightning from heaven. He was defeated. Brethren, a story starts to develop here. There is a true history. It's not the history you read in textbooks in school. I mean, that's short-term history. Anciently, there is an ancient history that took place before the foundations of the world. We're reading about that. We're getting snippets of it today. There is a story beginning to unfold. And the end of that story, brethren, is still about to be played out. But Job, the first chapter, Job 1, what do you think he's doing now? What do you think he's doing now? Well, Job found out pretty quick, didn't he? For some reason, Satan still can go up and plead his cause before God. Like, he can still go up there. He still has access to the throne of God. So he can go up there, you know, when other angels go up there, and he can plead his cause, make a case. Well, that's what he did with Job here. Brethren, Job was basically a very righteous man. He had a few flaws that God was trying to iron out. But look at what Satan did. It says in verse 7, well, actually verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God, meaning the angels, created sons. We are to be born again sons above the angels, but these are the created sons of God, the angelic host. They came to present themselves before the Eternal, and guess what? Satan came also among them. He could still go there, plead his cause. Verse 7, the Lord said to Satan, where'd you come from, Satan? Satan answered the Lord. He said, from going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. That's pretty real, brethren. That's pretty real. And he doesn't like you and he doesn't like me. And so he made a case against Job. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But essentially he said, you take away your protective barrier around Job and he'll curse you to your face. So God said, okay, you know, we'll take away the hedge. We'll take away the angelic protection. But save his life, Job. Or save his life, Satan. And so Satan was allowed to go and create havoc. His 10 kids died. He lost all of his cattle. His wealth was decimated terribly. But you know something? Job's response was, I'm not going to curse God. Not at all. It's his to give and it's his to take. Blessed be the name of the Lord in verse 21. And so, again, this happened again where Job in verse 2, or in chapter 2 of verse 2, same thing. Same thing. Because, brethren, you see, this is where Satan and his demons are confined at this time to this earth. They are confined here. God's kingdom is not here yet. It's the only place where God does not have authority and governance in that sense. He doesn't have his government functioning here on earth, but he's going to shortly. And you and I, brethren, are going to be part of that. We are going to establish the government of God on earth and remove Satan. And at that point, again, he will be cast into that bottomless pit for 1,000 years. But again, verse 2, another incident here, it says, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord in the third heaven at God's throne. Verse 2, and the Lord said to Satan, where did you come from, Satan? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro, yeah, same old story, from going through and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. And then the conversation goes, you saved his life, Lord. You saved his life, God. But let me afflict him from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet with sore boils. And then we'll hear what Job is really made of. Then we'll hear. And of course, it must have been an absolutely painful condition, brethren, because Job, from that point going forward, we don't know how long that conversation took place, but with his three so-called friends, and with friends like that, I'm not sure whether you need enemies, because all they did was poke at and prod at and tell Job and say, you really sinned. That's why God's done this to you. Well, Job really hadn't sinned. And they were trying to figure out what was going on, but he was in absolute agony, total agony. And then that brings you to the point in the 38th chapter, as we read previously, where God talks about his creation and how all of the angels rejoiced over that creation event. But again, how one third turned evil. They really did. Revelation, the 12th chapter. Revelation 12. Let's identify who our enemy is, because we have to deal with this enemy, brethren. And we have a spiritual arsenal to deal with it. We have a toolbox, or, you know, a our spiritual military hardware to deal with this adversary. We have to be armed. We do. For a short time yet, still going forward, we have to be armed. There's coming a time, brethren, when we won't have to worry about this evil, evil being at all. But right now we do. We need to be aware of him, and we need to be cognizant of his methods and his ploys. And his attempt, brethren, to discourage us from going to the feast. You know that? Really? You know, it seems like the two times a year where you have the biggest trial and stress is before the holy days in the spring and then before the holy days in the fall. Why is that? Because the holy days, brethren, picture God's plan of salvation. It pictures us and our ultimate transcendent potential of being born into the family of God and living for all eternity as true, full members of the family of God. Satan hates that, brethren. He wanted it all for himself. He really did. He still wants it to this day, brethren, because when you're insane, you know, it's like insanity on steroids. And that's where Satan's at. Revelation, the 12th chapter, verse 9. The great dragon was cast out. There is coming, brethren, a second attempt to attack God's throne in the third heaven. It's coming. Some people think it's already taken place by what's going on the world stage right now. Sometimes it makes you wonder, but probably not. We probably haven't crossed that threshold yet. But when we do, you know, it's going to be horrific, really. I mean, things will take place. But again, he will one last time at the very end attack, swoop up to God's throne and try to attack and knock him off his throne. But he's going to be very unsuccessful. But it says here, in verse 7, there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. What's he doing up there again? Well, he's trying to, again, do his plan all over again. The dragon fought and his angels. Verse 8, they prevailed not, and neither was their place found any more in heaven. Banished permanently from the third heaven. That was it. No more. And the only place that's left for him, little old planet Earth, brethren, where you and I reside. And Mr. Healy very well talked about the great tribulation that's coming. And one of the spin-offs of that great tribulation will be Satan enraged. He's going to be enraged, brethren, totally unleashed, unchained, unhinged. So it says here, called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. Brethren, why does mainstream religion believe that this is God's world? It is not God's world, brethren, not even close. Not even close, because you're reading Luke, the 4th chapter, Luke 4. Look at whose world technically it is. God owns it. I mean, he owns it, but he doesn't govern it. His kingdom is not here yet. It will be. But at this particular point in time, who governs this world? Luke, the 4th chapter, and I think I'm going to get this one right. Luke 4 and verses 5 through 8. This course is the face-off between Jesus Christ and Lucifer, or Satan. When Jesus Christ had to defeat him in this temptation, as it's called. And, of course, Christ had fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. He had to win this battle. This was a battle on earth, a battle to technically qualify to take control of this earth. And, of course, that still hasn't happened yet, but Christ certainly has qualified. There's no question about it. Verse 5 of Luke, the fourth chapter, take a look at this, brethren. It says, the devil taking him up into a high mountain. How that happened, we don't know. It is a mountainy area in Judea and parts of that land area. So it must have been a high mountain somewhere where you could see long off into the distance. But it says here, taking him up into a high mountain, showed to him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment in time, just sort of a flash by. You know, just flashed in front of them. You know, I kind of remember I went to Disney World a number of times with my kids, and there was this particular ride that I really liked because it was free. It was a free ride. But we went to Disney World, and I just forget about it. I think it was put on by an airline, but they took you on a ride through this imaginary place where they went past all the nations, the pictures of all the nations, and it was quite moving to see all those nations. Anyway, here, somehow, in a moment of time, all of the nations flashed in front of Christ. And he was weakened, brethren, just like you and I are today, except for Eugene. He doesn't get weak fasting. But he was weakened. 40 days of fasting. And so, again, you're craving for food. You're on a hair trigger. Somebody pokes you. You know, it's pretty tough to respond in a spiritual way. But Christ had control of it. He really did. And Christ knew why this whole temptation was taking place. It was over control of the kingdoms of this world. That's what it was all about. That's what this struggle was all about. He was going to qualify, or striving to qualify, to become King of Kings and Lord of Lords in the future. Not right then, but he will. So, what does Satan do? The devil takes him up into, of course, a mountain, and they saw all the kings of the world in a moment in time. Verse 6, the devil said to him, pretty sly, he knows how to tempt, doesn't he? Think of some of the thoughts that he injects into your mind, brethren. And you just have to take that thought, turn it around, and cast it out. Use all the spiritual power that you have to do that, because that's what Christ did as an example. It says, he says, the devil said to him, all this power? All this power will I give you, and the glory of them, as they were. Perhaps the Roman Empire looked pretty impressive. Perhaps Herod's kingdom in the eastern Mediterranean looked pretty impressive. Egypt, all these great kingdoms, flash them before Christ, who is in a terribly weakened state of fasting like you and I. Guess what? You can take the easy route. You don't have to be a human sacrifice. I'll give it to you right now. If I will give you the glory of them, because it's delivered to me, because to whomsoever I will, it's my decision, because God had left him in control of the earth for a period of time, as he still is today. I will give it to you if you therefore will worship me. Just that little itty bitty thing right there. Forget about God's way of life. Forget about living the hard, difficult road. Take the easy road, and you can have it all. Isn't that the way his thinking works, brethren? He presents his world to us almost like on a platter and says, you can have it all. That's what he's saying to you and I, brethren, but we can't have it all. We can't. because Satan is going to lose everything, and he's going to be banished for all eternity. For all eternity, brethren. So, there are many, many scriptures, brethren, that I really have not been able to go into. A couple of them, actually, I'll just touch on Isaiah the 14th chapter. Let's go there very quickly. Isaiah 14. If you can remember this, brethren, Isaiah the 14th chapter and Isaiah the 14th chapter and Ezekiel the 28th chapter are the two chapters that talk about the history of Satan's rebellion. And it talks about what actually did happen. And again, you won't learn this in a history class. You're not going to learn it in a school setting. You're not going to learn it at a university. It's not there because they don't believe it. But it's the truth. Let's read very quickly Isaiah 14, verse 12. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you fallen down and become the destroyer? That's one of his names in the book of Revelation, the destroyer, Apollyon. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? And oh, how he's doing that to this very day, brethren. Verse 13, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. Brethren, that's the antithesis to the mindset of God, because it's implying that he is taking to himself the right to decide what to do instead of following and believing God and doing what God tells us to do. I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. And one translator puts this next part this way. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregations in the sides of the north, in the third heaven. Verse 14. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be, and then some translators, brethren, strike the word like from here. And say that's kind of added by the translators. Possibly, maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. But you can read it this way. I will be the Most High. That's what happened to his mind. It became so corrupted. So terribly corrupted. And what a disaster the last 6,000 years of Earth's history have been. Of course, pre-Adamically, that became a disaster as well. Mr. Wally Smith wrote a book about some of those things in the evolution booklet, which touches on some of that. But it's just mind-boggling to think what happened way back when. It really, really is. Brethren, let's go to a few remaining scriptures here to kind of put the back end onto this whole message. Because we are still at a point where we are in a world held captive by Satan. It really is. It's his government. That's right. It's his governance. He wouldn't have said to Jesus Christ, I will give it all to you if you'll bow down to me, if it wasn't his to give. It really was. He had the authority and the power to give it. This is the demon power that you and I have to contend with. Now, the thing is, brethren, you and I are blessed because we have a resource that's accessible to us where we can be successful in our battle. But let's look at Revelation, the 20th chapter. Revelation 20. And this, of course, is after and probably just about. And they say there's a nine-day time frame. I mean, it's 9 days, basically, between, you know, if you call the calendar shows there's a nine-day space of time between Rosh Hashanah, which is the Feast of Trumpets, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, about 9 days. We don't know whether that's an exact time frame, meaning that that actually will be played out exactly that way, or whether it's just, you know, for the sake of you know, having a space there for the between the 2 days. We don't know whether it's significant, meaning it's going to be exactly 9 days between the time where Christ returns, takes over the earth, and then Satan is cast alive 9 days later. We don't know if that 9 days is exact or it's just an arbitrary figure. But anyway, either way, it says here, Revelation, the 20th chapter, I saw an angel come down from heaven. Which angel, we don't know. Perhaps Michael. Michael seemed to like to get into tussle with Satan, and he always came out on the good side of it, you know. There was Michael and Gabriel, two powerful archangels that rivaled Lucifer in power and strength, but they were the good guys, weren't they? They're the ones that are depicted in Daniel, the 12th chapter, as protecting Israel, both physical and spiritual, in the end of the age. So these angels, they came, or one of them came down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit. What is that? Well, you tell me, brethren, I don't know. I don't think Mr. Armstrong or Mr. Weston knows, or Mr. Meredith. I don't know whether they can describe it exactly. It seems to be some spiritual thing. When you step into the spirit world, there's a lot of things that you can't describe because we're really limited in that ability. But whatever that is, it's a bottomless pit. It's a condition of restraint. Not a nice place. Kind of probably like prison. And it's interesting, brethren, who is the one that dreamed up the hideous idea of incarcerating people in prisons, little cells, you know, these little horrible rat-infested cells in prisons, to put people away because they made some mistake, they broke some law or something like that. And so society has taken upon itself to condemn people to, you know, life in prison. I can't think of a more hideous existence, brethren. It's no wonder some people commit suicide because they go out of their minds in these places. Just horrible. But in actual fact, brethren, the one who is going to be committed to a prison-like circumstance is Lucifer, or Satan, and his demons. And that's what this is talking about. Cast away, removed from the world, so that there is no more prince of the power of the air influencing society, and so that the world tomorrow is going to be exempt from that influence. You know what's going to happen, don't you? You're going to have a world of peace, a world of happiness, of people living God's way of life, not being tested or tempted in that sense anymore, and being able to live and thrive, and to have the kind of lives that God originally intended for everybody, including the angels. You talk about a glorious time, and I can't imagine what that is going to be like, brethren. I don't think you can. It is going to be glorious. It is going to be stupendous. It is going to be like living the Garden of Eden 24/7 all the way around the world as this kingdom breaks forth and goes all the way around the world. It's going to be the Garden of Eden, brethren, all over again. People are going to be so happy and so filled with joy. And life is going to become what it was always intended to be, even as it would have been if Lucifer had not thought that thought and went astray and perverted his mind and brought about the greatest destructive decision and choice that ever took place in the history of eternity, I guess you could say. It says he laid hold upon the... he had a great hand chain in his hand. Verse 2, he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. Think he likes to hear that, brethren? There are church services all over the world right now reading these scriptures. You think Satan likes to hear that? I don't think so, brethren. I don't think so. But it's the truth, and it's going to happen. And this whole world's going to break forth into singing and rejoicing in a way that is absolutely unimaginable. It cast him, verse 3, into the bottomless pit, shut him up, set a seal on him that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that he shall be loosed for a little season. And again, He's going to be loosed for some reason. I guess the final test for those who live at the very end of the millennium, they're going to be told about it. You're going to watch out. Something's going to happen. You're going to be tested. You're going to be tried. You're going to be tested at that point. Guard your mind. Something's going to happen. We're going to let loose the deceiver. And you're going to be tested. And some people will fail that test, apparently. So, shut them up and set us until the 1,000 years shall be fulfilled. And after that, he shall be loosed for a little season. Brethren, this day, it's remarkable. It presents a profound answer to humanity's agony and humanity's sorrows. You know, the United Nations was a project that was begun with the best of intentions, but it didn't come close to achieving anywhere near what it was originally intended to achieve, because it didn't have the power to banish the real culprit, of all of these evils. You know, very quickly, I'm not going to turn there, but Leviticus 16th chapter, you might want to read that, brethren, because it talks about the Azazel goat, two goats presented before the high priest anciently in ancient times. One represented Jesus Christ, and the other one represented the scapegoat, or the Azazel goat, who typifies Satan. Initially, the sins of the world are placed on the first goat, which was Christ. But they don't stay there. Ultimately, they are removed and placed where they belong on the scapegoat, the Azazel goat, who represents Satan. And then he's taken and cast into a wilderness, away from God's kingdom, away from God's government, away from all that God has created that is beautiful and magnificent. In closing, brethren, we read that because the ultimate fate of Satan is still way off in the future. There is an initial fate. We just read that in Revelation, the 20th chapter, where Satan is going to be banished into some kind of a bottomless pit. You know, wouldn't it be interesting that bottomless pit maybe was somewhere around Rome or Babylon, some of the cities that typify or represent what he controlled in this world. And maybe that's where he belongs, you know, to see what he's done and to contemplate it. But in Jude, the 13th chapter, brethren, 13th chapter of Jude, right? Now you know, you're starting to suffer. But Jude, the 13th chapter, brethren, kind of finishes off the story and the fate of Satan and the ultimate fulfillment of the Day of Atonement, which will take place at the beginning. At the end, the Great White Throne Judgment period, the fire that engulfs the earth and burns it up, and then projecting forward into the new heavens and the new earth. And so when that takes place, brethren, there is a place for Satan, but it's apart. It's some black void where he'll spend all eternity, brethren, and cast away, because that's just about the only thing that God can do with a spirit being that goes sour. So the ultimate fulfillment of the Day of Atonement is written here in the 13th verse of Jude. Raging waves of the sea. You ever watch choppy oceans being bandied about by wind, you know, and the waves are choppy, foaming back and forth? Jude is likening that to the way the demons are. They're kind of restless, back and forth, out of control, all the rest of it. And he's likening that to the way the turmoil that they've created in this world today. Raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame, not hiding it. It's all there. Wandering stars, destitute, so different from what he's creating in you and I, brethren. We don't wander and wonder and, you know, just kind of in despair. We have such hope and such excitement about what's ahead for God's people, the family of God, the ultimate kingdom of God forever and ever and ever. Wandering stars, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. That, brethren, will be the ultimate completion of this Day of Atonement. But initially, brethren, we do have some exciting times ahead, because, again, we can look forward to the time of Satan's banishment for 1,000 years, and we'll be able to transform this world into a place of beauty, which is what the Feast of Tabernacles, soon coming upon us, will picture.